Oh man, yeah, you know what? I'm bored. I'm bored of
me. I wasn't talking about Gen Z anyway.
No, nor was I. I'm sorry. I don't actually give a shit about anything I was saying, and I hate myself, and I wish I was dead. How are you? Sorry, I'm chuckling again. It's when I laugh at my own. I think the worst thing is when I laugh at my own things, but I do that because. It's like there's silence, and I'm always laughing at my own things when you leave silence, because I think, well, if he's not laughing, I'm laughing. Or I'm opening one of these sweet, sweet, sweet cans. The cans are laughing. The cans will help me laugh.
You were drinking when I spoke to you many hours earlier. Have you had a break? Did you have a dinner break?
I saw All of Us Strangers as well, which you recommended me to see. I'd never heard of this film before.
Yes.
You know, I'd been, in fact, you know what? Can you tell me about it again? Because I have not even, it's not even been on my radar and I've seen it.
Well, I know not everyone's heard of this film, Adam, and I know you hadn't. You're welcome for my introduction to it. It's a little known film, very indie. That's the word, that's the buzzword of the time, very indie. And it's got a couple of actors in who you've probably seen, but you wouldn't know their names because you're not a good or cool person. Paul Mescal, Andrew Scott, in this film, and I don't really know how to describe it similarly without giving anything away, because I'm wondering now you have seen it, would you encourage the audience to view if they find it to be an appeasing sort of aperitif?
I wouldn't recommend this film for people to watch.
You wouldn't?
On a personal basis, if I'm having a chat with someone, I wouldn't go, oh, I watched All of Us Strangers, you should definitely watch this. But right. I wouldn't not recommend it to people listening to the podcast if they were, for example, if they said, oh, I want to watch a well-acted, sort of sad, romantic film about what it means to be alive and be in love.
Uh-huh.
I'd say, oh, yeah, that you watch All of Us Strangers. I mean, that wouldn't even be the first film I'd say, but if they were asking, should I watch All of Us Strangers? I'd go, yeah, sure, why not? It baffles me that it was such a big part of the conversation last year.
Yeah.
I think possibly because of the Mescal magic. He's magic in this movie. And he's barely in it. He's in maybe four scenes and he feels like he's in the whole movie.
Yeah.
I don't like Andrew Scott. I don't understand how he is.
In the film?
In general.
Or just general?
As an actor, I think I can't understand I can see him acting. And I don't mind him. He's very watchable. I'm watching him in the Netflix Ripley thing. It's just I can see him acting. I can see the decisions he's making. Whereas Mescal, I have no idea how he's doing what he's doing. And so I'd much rather watch Mescal's movie. But unfortunately, Strangers is Andrew Scott's movie.
Yeah.
He's technically he's a good craftsman. But I do not believe anything he's ever done, ever.
Do you remember, you've seen Pride, right?
I have seen Pride. And
because there's a scene in Pride.
Yeah.
Do you remember the scene in Pride where... Is he in
Pride?
Yes.
Because I've genuinely forgotten him being in that movie.
Have you?
I connect the younger lad. What's he called? There's a younger lad who's in it. Who's in it?
The fella. I can't remember his name. But no, he's in
Broad
Pride.
Face, George McKay.
Sure. Yeah.
Sorry,
good.
Sorry.
No. Good bit. That's a good bit where you could remember the name of the what was his name again? George McKay.
George McKay. 1917. George McKay.
There we go. That's the one. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's
where's
him.
Andrew Scott in the movie?
Andrew Scott is going out with the McNulty, Detective McNulty. What's his name?
He is in that, isn't he? He's a smaller.
It's a very small part, but it's a beautiful part. Yeah, and he's from Rhyl in North Wales, and there's a moment where one of the women from the mining village in Wales that the gays and lesbians have been visiting calls the shop, and Andrew Scott answers, and they have a quick chat, and she says Nadolig Llawen, which means Merry Christmas in Welsh, and there's that. Plus, when he goes back to visit his mother in Rhyl for the first time in however many, 20 years or something, he's in the film for very short periods of time, and he totally owns the movie. Like he steals the show with that part, and I can't see him acting in it at all. I may not have the analytical eye of someone such as yourself, but he completely wins that film. And that's the moment when I thought, wow, this guy's a terrific actor.
Yeah, I get for you. He's salt, man. I want him as salt. I don't want him as steak. Okay, he's the seasoning, and he works. He can turn up to do two scenes, but as soon as he's about for any longer, and he's in so much, he's insufferably around for a lot longer.
Right.
Again, I say insufferably. I always turn everything up to 11. I don't mean that. It's not my thing.
He's not your Paul Mescal.
No, Paul Mescal, man. Paul Mescal is, fuck me, man. He's amazing in All of Us Strangers.
He is amazing.
He's all of it. Oh, man. Oh, actually, I'm opening the Paul Mescal.
If you want to open the Paul Mescal box, then I want to pour out some of the contents that I believe live within the Paul Mescal box. Now, we don't know. Because it's Schrodinger, there's a cat, there are other things in the Paul Mescal box. But if we were to untip the box of Paul Mescal and untip its contents onto the carpet of Andrew Scott, what I think we would find is that he's absolutely terrific in Normal People, which is a lovely TV show based on a very popular book. He's obviously terrific in After Sun, which is a film very close to your heart.
Try Phenomenal, mate.
He's phenomenal in a phenomenal film, yeah. I think he's really great in All of Us Strangers, yeah. But I also think that Paul Mescal has done the same thing in all of those things. And it's a beautiful, wonderful thing. But I do think now he's a big star, and he is a big star. We're talking about Gladiator today. He's the star of Gladiator 2. Okay.
I told you this, by the way. I told you this.
Yeah. I think in about 2-3 years' time, people are going to start to turn on Mescal, and they're going to start to say, is he everything that the audience hopes that he's going to be, to live up to in the future? I don't know that he is.
And I would say that is the least interesting question to ask. Everything you said up to that, I'm kind of on board with. I'm yes. Mm. Fair play. I couldn't give a shit what people start to turn against. When we start talking about turn against, we are foreshadowing our conversation about Russell Crowe here. Whether people start turning against the magic of Paul Mescal is irrelevant. The interesting thing is you and what you think what he's going to do in Gladiator 2. And what you think he's going to be as an actor. I'm interested in that and your kind of imaginings. Like, in fact, we talked about it with Tom Hardy, and you nailed it with Tom Hardy. Where you
That's
sort
what
of
I
said,
was going to raise.
You said, oh, Tom Hardy, everyone thought he was a great actor. And actually, it was like, oh no, that's just the guy.
That's the thing he does. That's his one thing.
If that's what you're going to predict for Mescal, fair dues, put a tenner on at the bookies. You've laid it down here.
Yeah,
I'm not going to tell you not to make that bet. I feel like, I'm a hopeful guy. I'm a positive guy.
Sure,
I just don't want that to be true. Hello. And welcome to the Movies You Forgot podcast with me, your host, Adam Richmond. And joining me as ever is Mr. Joe Devine.
Hello. No leaky bucket brain today.
No, not today.
Well, The day has only just begun.
This is the podcast in which we talk about the films we forgot we'd even seen in the first place. The reason why you're not the leaky bucket boy today, Joe, is because we're talking about a movie that the container of your head has never allowed any spillage from within.
That's true. I'm sloshing about.
You're not even sloshing. It's just encased in iron. I don't know why, but there's a kind of within the bucket of your head that is leaky. There's a sub bucket that is actually cast iron.
Yeah.
And within that is the container. It contains Gladiator
and Lord of the Rings.
And Lord of the Rings. No, I did a different joke about Lord of the Rings for this. the Lord of the Rings thing is something else. This Gladiator is in this inner cast iron bucket.
Yeah.
Do you know why I bring up Gladiator? Because that is the movie that we are doing. I can't imagine this as being a forgot you forgot, but I forgot this.
You did? Yeah.
And it is the 2000 film directed by Ridley Scott.
Oof.
And it stars Rusty Crowe. And I'm just gonna go straight in, okay? Letterboxd, runtime. It's 155 mins.
Oof, 155 mins of pure gold.
And incidentally, I know everyone wants to know what I think of this film, but you're not gonna find out. Joe's not gonna find out, and you're not gonna find out until the end of the episode.
You're not gonna tell me until we get to the end.
Yeah.
You've been keeping this quiet from me. You've been keeping shtum about this. I thought you were...
Shtum. I'm so shtum on what I think of on rewatching this film. But here's the Letterboxd. A hero will rise. In the year 180, the death of Emperor Marcus Aurelius throws the Roman Empire into chaos. Maximus, played by Russell Crowe, is one of the Roman army's most capable and trusted generals and a key advisor to the emperor. As Marcus's devious son Commodus, played by Joaquin Phoenix, ascends to the throne...
Commodus.
As Marcus's devious son Commodus ascends to the throne, Maximus is set to be executed.
Either you're just being stubborn or you're giving away what you thought of the film by calling him Commodus.
He escapes, and by he, we mean Maximus here. Mm-hmm. He escapes, but is captured by slave traders, renamed Spaniard. I mean, for some reason. Renamed Spaniard and forced to become a gladiator, Maximus must battle to the death with other men for the amusement of paying audiences. And that's where the Letterboxd...
With other men, does it say? It says with other men.
Yeah.
Who do they think we think he'll be battling to the death with?
With children.
Yeah, with children, with animals, you know, with inanimate objects.
It misses a key point to Russell Crowe's story, is that Commodus is responsible for the death of his wife and son.
But you're going to call him Commodus all episodes.
Is that a problem if I call him Commodus?
I don't know. I don't think it would legally qualify, but it bothers me.
Commodus.
Yeah, oh, there we go. Now I feel like you're taking it seriously and me seriously.
Okay, so Letterboxd is missing key info.
Yeah.
Rusty Crowe has been charged by Aurelius, his father figure, to kind of return order and democracy to Rome.
Yes.
Joaquin Phoenix, Commodus. I'm going to call him Joaquin Phoenix. Joaquin Phoenix is the petulant son.
Yeah.
He's livid. He kills daddy. Crowe gets stitched up and he's going to get killed. Of course, he escapes. But of course, his wife and son are murdered.
Oh, no.
And he ends up slack alley. So, you know, he's got one thing on the mind, revenge.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's the movie. This film was huge in 2000.
Yeah.
I remember I was at university and I got to see a preview of it.
Did you?
I did. I remember that in the lead up to this, Ridley Scott was coming off the back of a couple of real stinkers. He directed G.I. Jane, which was much derided. And I still have never seen. And He was really, he'd completely gone off the boil. He hadn't done anything of any note, but he still had this aura about him. And, you know, everyone's chatting. He's like, I'm going to do a gladiator flick, and Russell Crowe's going to be the lead. And it was, as I recall, it was all a bit of a joke. Everyone expected it to be a stinker. This kind of movie had not been in cineplexes for fucking ages. The last kind of film like this, I think, that had bothered the box office was Cutthroat Island, which was a pirate movie. Mm. That was a notorious flop, and it was a disaster. And then it came out, Joe.
Mm.
It came out, and boy, everyone lapped it up.
It changed the world, Adam. It changed the Holly world.
It changed the Holly world. I think Swords, sandals, epics.
Yeah.
It kind of reopened the door to all that kind of stuff. And, it definitely shifted stuff. It's also a year before 9/11, which is interesting. What are your memories of seeing Gladiator? And did you see it in the movies?
For new listeners to the podcast, Adam's reference to 9/11 there is a pointed attack on me for saying once before that the publication of something in relation to that event was of interest. So not relevant, but just a little under the table jab at my penis there. But I evaded it. It's all fine.
I think it's actually slightly. I don't know whether we'd be able to figure out why it's interesting, but I do think the fact. I don't know necessarily whether you would tell a story like Gladiator in a post 9/11 world in the same way.
I didn't watch it in the cinema because I was 9 or 10 years old, okay? But unusually for me, Adam, I do have a story about seeing this film for the first time. And it's rare for me because normally I can't remember anything about seeing a film for the first time. But this one specifically, I lived in a place with my parents for about 3 years in this house between other houses. And I had a best friend where we were living. He was about, you know, a 5-minute walk around the roads. And he had Gladiator at his house, as well as Virtua Tennis 2 on the Sega Dreamcast. So his house was the place to be. And his house was where I saw Gladiator for the first time, and I remember feeling, I think it was probably one of the first times I'd watched a video in someone else's home that maybe my mother wouldn't have let me watch at home. You know, there was something that felt a little bit naughty about it as well, something restricted.
It's pretty violent.
It's pretty violent
for 10 or 11.
Might have been like 2002 or 2001 by the time I watched it. And then I was, you know, we're talking 11, 12, something like that.
It was a woman gets chopped in half.
Yeah, that's right.
A man gets stabbed by two swords.
Yeah.
There's a real splatter.
That's right. A lot of splatter. And you know what? I loved it. Couldn't get enough. Actually, don't really remember that specifically. But I do remember feeling like it was, there was something, it was something that I wasn't supposed to be doing. And I loved the film.
I didn't like the film when I watched it.
You didn't, no.
That
time, the preview you were just talking about, was that the last time you saw it?
I would have seen it on DVD. I'm pretty sure the family, I think my brother would have bought it on DVD. So I would have seen it subsequent to that, maybe two years after release. And then it just would have just, I think, I just consigned it to the bin.
Yeah.
Because I don't care about Romans. I don't like swords and that kind of clashing. Anyone who's listened to Kingdom of Heaven episode, well, now I don't care for that kind of thing.
Sure.
Although I don't mind Braveheart. I don't mind Braveheart.
You don't mind Game of Thrones?
Yeah, but I like Game of Thrones for other things. There are clashing other things that I like in Thrones. But I think maybe I prefer Braveheart because I saw that at a formative age of 15.
Yeah.
And I felt like, oh, wow, I've never seen this before.
Sure.
Mel Gibson has reinvented cinema.
Yeah.
Thanks, Mel. You've done it.
Oh, Mel did it again.
Good old Mel. Whatever happened to Mel Gibson?
Well, I think he TikTok tells me that he can just hear what all women think, and that's what happens. So now he's working in a marketing office somewhere, and he's just using women's own thoughts against them.
Oh, Mel. Oh, the things you say and think.
Yeah.
But yeah, it has. It's obviously had a big old. It had a big old imprint on culture.
Uh-huh.
It very much launched old Rusty Crowe.
Oh, big time, big time.
He was already very much popping. He's on. He's on quite a streak after Gladiator.
Do you want to dive into Rusty?
I want to dive into Rusty. Yeah,
throw me some Rusty, because I'd love to know what he was doing before Gladiator.
Well, he popped up first in a very violent Aussie flick called Romper Stomper. Playing a Nazi.
Right.
Well, a skinhead. Much like Ryan Gosling. Do you think when he starred with Ryan Gosling in The Nice Guys, they were both kind of going, hey, we were both launched our careers by playing skinheads?
Almost certainly they were. I think that, you know, they wouldn't have stopped talking about it.
He got into Hollywood because Sharon Stone saw him and she basically insisted he got hired for The Quick and the Dead. Have you seen that?
No.
You should. It's got Leonardo DiCaprio in.
Has it?
And it's directed by Sam Raimi. It's got Gene Hackman in, my favourite.
I'll watch it. I'm now starting to think, though, maybe I haven't seen any Rusty Crowe films pre-Gladiator.
That film, Quick and the Dead, should have been a bit bigger. It didn't do anything. But then he manages to land LA Confidential.
Oh, I have seen that. Yeah, my bad.
That's his first big Hollywood break.
You can get me so hard on that, by the way, at some point, because I have zero recollection of that film and I constantly forget that it exists.
The year before Gladiator, he's in The Insider, directed by Michael Mann.
Oh, yeah.
And he is so good in that. That film is so good. So he's already ticking the boxes.
He's carving out a Rusty Crowe for himself.
He's already Paul Mescaling the shit out of his life.
Yeah,
and then he's in Gladiator, and then everyone realizes this guy's a star.
He's a star. He commands an aura, that man. He really does.
The next three films after that, Proof of Life, which is more known for him having an affair with Meg Ryan, but then you've got A Beautiful Mind, Oscar buzz, and then Master and Commander.
Oh yeah,
a big ship film.
Could also get me on that.
I never saw it.
Didn't you?
And then he's trying to star in... He's starring in stuff like Cinderella Man. Kind of big budget Oscar bait.
A good year.
Yeah, and then but he's in, you know, 3:10 to Yuma, Body of Lies. These kind of really meaty, big budget Hollywood dramas that cost like 80 to 100 million that they don't really make anymore. And he's the star. He's this big... I was thinking about it today. I think he's Mel Gibson.
Yeah,
he's the once, but without like the stupid jokes and the anti-Semitism.
Yeah, he could be Mad Max, couldn't he?
Mm. He totally could have been Mad Max,
Daddy Max, Granddaddy Max.
He's better. He's a better actor than Mel Gibson. I really like him. But he's now a bit of a joke. Would you not agree? I mean, where do you stand on Crowe?
I don't know. I mean, I love Crowe. I think everything... I enjoy Crowe in everything that he's in. I enjoyed him in American... What's it called? With Denzel Washington, where they're mano a mano.
Yeah, he's so good in that. American Gangster.
American Gangster, which is, you know, a really fun film. I think it's a little bit slept on.
Well, just a little bit, mate. It's super slept on, that film.
Yeah. And I really like it. And also, he does something a little bit different in there, too. He's still got his little cheeky grin. He's still kind of funny. He's still a little devil may care. And, you know, he's a great... He plays a great maverick because I believe him. You know, he's got this sort of amazing power.
I think he's renowned for having this big ego. And I think it's a testament to the fact that he's in a film where he's obviously the more attractive, flashier part isn't his. It's Denzel Washington.
Yeah.
He's almost number two.
Arguably, that's the same in Nice Guys as well, which, you know, is a more recent Russell Crowe film. He's a more recent and slightly different sort of Russell Crowe. He's really funny in that film, and he plays off brilliantly with Ryan Gosling. The two of them together, they're a dream. And I think I see your point about the ego confusion thing, because he's superb at taking a back seat in that film when it's required of him, leaving space for someone else to be funny and someone else to shine when it's required of him. And I don't know him personally at all, obviously.
What?
It wouldn't surprise me if he had an ego, because he's a massive movie star. But I don't think that very often reflects on screen. So he does a good job of hiding it if it's there.
There was a famous, infamous BAFTA thing where he was going to get an award, and he wanted to read out a poem, and he got cut short. And afterwards there was some to-do about it from old Rusty Crowe.
Right.
So I think in this country, England, there's certainly the tabloids.
We hate Rusty Crowe.
Well, no, the tabloids certainly like to... They've painted him as kind of a pompous, self-serious kind of guy. And I think...
Artist wishes to read poem.
It's easy to just say our tabloids are disgusting and whatever. Anyway, the nice guys is... That's the point. Everything after the nice guys, he doesn't really... He's not in anything of any note. He kind of disappears. He's in a lot of shit. And he's kind of considered as a joke now.
Sure. He also takes a slight turn around Les Mis as well, it's worth saying. Like, it's, I think it's great that he did that and that he tries to do that. He can't really sing. He can hit the note, but I think there's a difference between like hitting the right note and singing. But he sticks it out. He wants to do it. He's there. He shows up. I kind of appreciate that. And I like seeing him in it, even though he's definitely not like the best musical performer.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's too far back, Les Mis. He's not taking a turn there. Like, I think he's taking a step back. Like, he's obviously not the main guy in Les Mis, and then he's Jor-El in Man of Steel, aka Superman's dad. He's such a good Superman's dad, and I love the fact that he would do something like that. You need to have a certain ego to be a big star, and then eventually the tabloids or the people kind of go, they just turn on you. They just think, oh, you know what, forget it. You're too big for your boots. We've decided you're shit, and fuck off. And I feel like that's what people have done to Russell Crowe. And I think that's a shame, because he's really good. I love him in LA Confidential.
I'm a big fan, and I think he knows what he's doing. He's an experienced actor. Films are better with him in, I reckon.
He just doesn't get enough credit. Like, on Gladiator, in the original script, I think it was down to who? What's the character? She's an attractive. She's Joaquin Phoenix's attractive sister,
Lucilla.
Marcus Aurelius's daughter,
played by Connie Nielsen.
Connie Nielsen, fantastic in The Devil's Advocate, and she has. She's painted as a bit of a sort of as she's always fancied Maximus,
yeah,
aka Rusty Crowe.
They had a thing back in the day, back in high school, in Roman high school.
But she was denied his pure manhood.
Sure.
And towards the end of the film, she kind of realizes that her brother Commodus is a real dick.
Yeah.
Anyway, there are a couple of scenes between her and Rusty Crowe. In the script, as written, they were supposed to shag because they've obviously got real sexual chemistry, and people want to see characters shag.
Yeah.
And Rusty Crowe said, what are you talking about? You know, my wife's dead. The whole thing about my character is my wife's dead and I'm mourning my wife. She's not even cold in the ground. I'm not going to shag. You know, this woman who was obviously very attractive, but I'm not going to do it. The character wouldn't do that.
It would undercut his kind of his moral righteousness, right?
I mean, there is a bit where she, right towards the end, where she kisses him. And I thought, oh, this is quite saucy. And that's the bit where they probably would have had sex.
Yeah.
But they get the moment there because she kisses him. He lets her. Oh, yeah. I'm so moral. He lets her kiss him.
Sure.
But they don't go full bone tone.
No.
Anyway, they don't do that because it wouldn't fit the movie. And Rusty Crowe knows these things, and he's, you know, he's going to call it. And I, you know, I just don't think he gets enough credit, man.
I agree. His character's very consistent all the way throughout the film. I think the one consistency of Maximus Decimus Meridius, yeah, the one consistency of him is he's a soldier. From the beginning to end, he never, like, he's a smart soldier. He's risen up the ranks. He's become a general. He can converse with these politicians and leaders, but he's an ordinary man, and he's not educated in the way that these other people are, right? He never pretends to be. He's not a hero in that way. And what is he? A soldier. What does a soldier do? He does what he's fucking told, Adam. That's what he does all the way throughout the film. Is exactly what he's told. And it culminates in this wonderful moment at the end of the film when he's dying and he's lifting his head up all weak. He's draining from blood. He's looking up at Lucilla and she says, "Go to them." And then he dies. And I think, oh yeah, he just got permission to die. So he died on the spot. He's a soldier to the end. He doesn't have these grander visions of being anything more, that, which is also the same reason why Richard Harris, as the Emperor Marcus Aurelius, who dies at the beginning, he knows he can entrust the fate of Rome to Russell Crowe, because Russell Crowe would never dream to take power for himself. He's just a soldier.
Yeah, that's very much the kind of, I think, the Ridley Scott view of the world, that you can't trust power to people who want power.
Yeah.
It's you've got to say, no, I don't want it. Oh, yeah. You passed the test. You're just the guy for it.
Maximus, that's why it must be you.
Yeah, but have a little bit of knowledge and interest. No. I want to go back to my wife and farm. No, that means you're the right guy for it. Really? A little bit of book learning about politics and, you know, human behavior and economics and, why we do, how to order a society. No. Let's give it to the guy who's got the least interest possible.
He's a moral man, you know. He believes in principle. At the beginning, the interesting fun thing is you would think that he, as the soldier, as the man who's just killed, you know, dozens of Germanian woods people out there, the man that's killed all of these people would be the one questioning the purpose, but he's not. It's the emperor. It's the emperor that says, "What was this for? All I did was bring the sword over 30 years," and recounts the number of, you know, the small number of years that he'd had peace under his reign. Russell Crowe is the one who convinces him otherwise, or tries to, says, "No, we did it for the glory of Rome." He's full of these kind of false illusions, and that's what I mean by the consistency of him as a character all the way throughout. He's a kind of unwavering in his unquestioning nature. He just does what he thinks is the right thing to do, or what he's been told to do by people who he thinks tell him to do the right thing. That it's a beautiful simplicity, and also I do think it's terrifically consistent throughout. They show him as an incredibly powerful warrior, but they don't show him as like a man of great intellect or education or someone who immediately grasps everything. He needs to be taught everything the whole way through the film and rely on these other people. And that's nice, man. Like, normally in these movies, the main character would be a fish out of water, yes, but would instantly show everyone in every scene that he was so much better than all of those other people. And that's not Russell Crowe.
Yeah, he is consistently thick. You're right. And yeah. it's the mistake of when we, you know, to flash back to the Kingdom of Heaven episode, Orlando Bloom's character, who is a kind of, he's basically Rusty Crowe minus 1,000. They make him an expert in everything. He suddenly knows modern warfare. He knows how to maneuver whatever.
He knows how to build irrigation systems in the desert.
But I think this is where they do the kind of hero's journey where he just says, "Oh no, I wouldn't know anything about that. Oh, yeah. I couldn't possibly." Yeah. No. He's very humble, kind of insufferably humble.
The kind of man that you'd go, "Fuck that guy. What's wrong with him? Dig up the skeleton. Where is it? What's he done wrong?" Short of, you know, being an incredible killer and, you know, ending the lives of many people.
You know, the first time he becomes a gladiator, he gets taken into gladiator school, as schooled by Oliver Reed in his Oliver Reed's last performance.
Who I fucking love in this film, by the way.
Well, Oliver Reed, again, he was a big joke and had been forgotten and was this kind of laughed at, soused kind of guy. And then Ridley Scott casts him. He died during the filming, so they kind of had to bodge together an ending. And I think they do just a good enough job to see off the character.
They do.
Oliver Reed, you see this, and he's probably right up there. He really gets what the film is. He knows what to do. But
Shadows and Dust, Maximus. Shadows and Dust.
Russell Crowe gets taken to gladiator school, and then
can I say just while we're on Oliver Reed before we move on, Proximo, one of the first lines you hear from him when you meet him is he's on the back of his camel or his elephant or whatever. He's been walked into his house by these servants either side of them, these giraffes, and he goes, "Come on, how long does it take to get into my fucking house?" And I think, was that in the script? Was it? I'd love if that wasn't in the script. I'd love if he embodied the character such that he knew this man in this moment would scream irritably at his servants for not moving an elephant fast enough. You know, it's lovely.
Yeah, and I think Paolo Canci had a lovely time. I think they were all out in Malta just loving life.
Right.
So, yeah, what a way to go. But, so Rusty Crowe's in gladiator school. He's like, I'm done fighting. Yeah. I've been fucked over. This is it. And then it's like the next scene is like, all right, yeah, go on then. I'll fucking kill everyone.
I knew you were going to say this.
It's a bit quick.
I prepared for this.
For a big sprawl of a film that spans time.
Ooh,
it spans so much time, this film.
Yes,
there's some very, fairly, fairly abrupt storytelling.
Sure.
Am I wrong?
No, you're not wrong, but and listen, I prepared for this because I watched it through your eyes, as I want to do in these situations. How do I protect myself from the glare of Richmond? Well, I embody the glare of Richmond, and I watch this film through the eyes of Richmond. And I did see in that scene, you're right, he's at gladiator school. He's about to fight the big German Hagen, who's a good fun as a character, just a big lad, Ralph Müller. Anyway.
Not long for this world.
Did he die? Did he die also?
Towards the end, he really gets...
Oh, the character. I thought you were talking about Ralph Müller after we talked about Oliver Reed dying. Okay, fine. It's like the gladiator curse.
We're all not long for this world.
No, that is true.
Imagine that, anyway, 20 years later, another gladiator actor dies. The gladiator curse. It's like, I think that's just life. Just life, guys.
Sure.
Sorry.
No, that's fine. That's a joke from... who's that a joke from? It's Norm Macdonald. You heard that one? Where he says the name of the guy from The Doors. And this is in like 2018. And he goes, this person's died. The curse of The Doors. It's very funny.
I love your Norm Macdonald references. Can I just give me a little splash of red wine and then you carry on the story?
Why don't I have a cigarette? You have a splash of red wine. And when we come back, we'll tell the listeners about this other incredible thing I'm about to say.
Don't forget, you were just about to go into... Oh, yeah, your rebuttal.
Yeah, well, it's about the he does fight scene.
Yeah.
And we'll
pop
a jingle in there. Yeah.
It's amazing. Okay. It's amazing that you've pre-prepared the exact...
I knew. Well, I just knew that was the bit that you were going to...
It's a small niggle.
It's a small niggle.
And I don't want to pick... I'm not a nitpicker anymore.
No. Sure, I know you're not.
After The Martian...
I can hear it.
I don't nitpick.
Guess what I love about this episode so far? I've no clue what you thought about the film, and I like hearing how you're engaging with the film. It's good, it's working for me.
Setting myself up as a fucking asshole.
So obviously instinct is going to come out and he's going to slay them because that's what happens. He is a soldier. That's what he does. Okay. So I buy it completely. It does happen a little quickly. Does it happen too quickly? It does happen a little quickly, but the film's already 2.5 hours long. And I think what Ridders does here, Ridley Scott, I think he goes, okay, the audience have seen that. They know the power of this. Do they need another half an hour? No. They get it. Let's just get him killing some people. And if I have one criticism of this film, a film I love deeply, it's that there's too much time between Rusty Crowe killing people, okay? That's it. And all the time's important, but there's just too much time between those big, wonderful Rusty Crowe does fighting set pieces.
Yeah. No, do you know what? It's a good pushback because, you know, what are you going to do? He's thrown into the arena. It's fuck or walk. He fucks.
And boy, does he fuck.
At that point, it's 50 minutes into the film. Yeah. It takes 50 minutes for him to be a gladiator. And I'm just gonna leave that.
But it doesn't
there.
Take 50 minutes for him Should to do some fighting because the film opens with him doing wonderful fighting.
No. Hey, listen, mm-hmm. I'm the host.
Well,
that comment is just to be left there hanging.
Uh-huh. The audience and I know. We know.
It's not a comment on whether you know there's fighting or mm-hmm. not. I'm mm-hmm. saying it's 50 minutes yep. until he becomes a gladiator. Yeah. That's all
it's funny, isn't it, though? Let me just... It doesn't need, I'm going to leave that hanging. I'm going to leave that hanging. I'm not kicking back on that. But what I will say is that it's funny how in one moment you go from saying, it happens too quickly, I just don't believe it, to then complaining about how long something took. It's interesting, isn't it? That's all I'll say. And I'll just leave that there. I'm leaving that hanging. There's no need to respond to that.
Can we talk about Joaquin Phoenix?
I'd love to. Commodus.
Commodus mm-hmm. Rex. Now... This is
the bit, by the way, where I really want to know whether you like the film or not. I know you're not going to tell me yet, but I just want you to know on the timeline of me, this is the section where I'm desperate to know.
Okay, so this is where I'm going to have to start. I don't want to say what I think of this film because Joe recently sent me the edit for The Revenant. Now, in Nolan time, the dream is collapsing. The space between... when we record and release episodes is narrowing.
Yeah.
And he sent me that episode.
We're flagging.
And I was appalled to hear what a horrible, miserable little shit I was for 2 hours.
We cut most of that out.
Yeah, exactly. And then it's like a 40-minute episode. I listen to that guy and I don't want to be that guy. It was a real turn off and it was a real wake up call.
The personal attacks in that episode were funny.
I thought that's the thing in my head when I was doing it. I thought this is all my tongue is in my cheek. Yeah. But then I listen back and I just think, I just sound mean-spirited.
Yeah, yeah.
So everything I say now mm-hmm. is going to be measured and thoughtful and kind.
Yeah.
And I will have to start tipping my hand as to what I thought of this film.
Oh, no.
Speaking about Joaquin Phoenix.
Oh, no.
And his performance in it. Because Joaquin Phoenix's performance in this film is duff as fuck.
Do you really think so?
This is a quote from Joe's book of quotes. Mm-hmm. He can't do it.
Oh no.
And he can now, but he couldn't then. And there's a couple of moments actually where you get little flashes of you go, oh, this is he Joaquin Phoenix is undeniably now a very talented actor.
Here's what's to come.
And there are little flashes of here's what's to come. But he's duff. I don't know how else to put it. He's duff as fuck. He's not threatening. And I don't necessarily... Before I'd rewatched it, I think I parked it fully at his door as not having it. And I think the script is to blame because the interesting thing about his character is before he kills his father... He's a daddy's boy. but daddy loves another boy.
Yeah.
And there's a really interesting dynamic there. And I don't, I just think, I'm trying to be kind to Joaquin here.
Mm-hmm.
I think where they take him, they turn him from a quite interesting character into a grubby little pervert who wants to fuck his sister.
Yeah.
And he could be, he could have been a genuinely interesting antagonist to Rusty Crow as just someone, as someone who has been usurped.
Yeah.
Daddy-wise.
Yeah.
But the film just goes full throttle, we're going to make him a grubby little pervert and we're going to make you hate him and we're going to make everyone hate him.
Yeah.
And it just becomes, it becomes, he becomes this petulant, horrible little guy. And I, it's a, yeah, it, it's not, he's not fun to watch. I don't think he's got it. And I can't believe that he ended up being the actor that he is off the back of this. Do you like him in this?
Yeah, I do like him in it. And I know what you mean. I don't think it's certainly not Joaquin Phoenix's strongest performance, but I say that, you know, about someone who has a career full of very strong performances. So I don't think that's too much of a criticism. I take the point about his character. I think that's a really good and insightful one, because you're right. Like, the most interesting scene with Joaquin Phoenix in, and the best scene, that he, his best performance in the film, is very early on when his father, the emperor, tells him that he's not going to succeed him. And Joaquin Phoenix goes on to express to his father how he feels about him and then kill him, right? And it's a great scene. It's really fun. It's really well written. It's also a great reminder of something I think this film does really well, which is that Marcus Aurelius, as the emperor, he's lauded by Russell Crowe, and the film kind of sets him as this great moral arbiter, but the character himself recognizes everything, almost everything, that's terrible about him, and he is terrible. In the scene where he sees his son for the first time in many months, Joaquin Phoenix has been called, along with his sister Lucilla, to come to the front where the war is in Germania and see his father. And Joaquin Phoenix, as soon as he arrives at the camp, he asks after him. The soldiers say, "Oh, he's at the front. They've been gone for 20 days or something." He hops on his horse. He's excited to see his father. He rides out. He gets there. His father is arm in arm with Maximus. And upon seeing Joaquin Phoenix, he displays no interest in him. He's not pleased to see him. He doesn't embrace him. He doesn't even say, "Hi, thanks for coming." He says nothing, right? And then when Joaquin Phoenix tries to take his arm and walk and talk with him, he leaves him and allows this other man to help him get on his horse. And then he sees his daughter for the first time in, again, many months. And they lock arm in arm, and she understands the game. She knows what's going on. And there's a wonderful line in this exchange between them where he says, "Enough of politics. Let us pretend that you are a loving daughter and I am a good father," right? Which is a fucking horrible thing to say to your daughter. Similarly, later, when Joaquin Phoenix expresses everything, all of this stuff that's been hepped up.
That's what I say to her every time I go to pick up Rosie from school. That's what I say to her. I say, "Let us be done with politics, Rosie." Yeah. Let us pretend
that you're a loving daughter. Joaquin Phoenix has just said, like, "All I ever wanted was for you to love me. You once wrote me a letter," he says, listing the four great attributes. And as I read it, I realized I had none of them, right? So this is a long history. This is the scene. A long story of this boy who's looking up to his father, who all he wants is for his father to love him, and his father doesn't, right? And when he's done, like, bearing his heart to this man, putting his heart in this man's hands, do you know what the man says? He says, "Your faults as a son, or your misgivings as a son or something, are my faults as a father." And I think, you fucking cunt, man. Not only is that, like, totally the correct, but also is the absolutely the last thing that you should say to someone in this situation, and you deserve to be murdered. And so I think Joaquin Phoenix is wonderful in that scene. And you're right, another criticism of the film is it lets that strain go, and it actually uses the Commodus character more as a plot device to ensure that when Lucilla, his sister, comes to plot with Russell Crowe, that you believe it because she needs protection from this guy who not just only just wants to kill her, he wants to fuck her as well, right? Like it just goes off on this weird tangent, I think, and doesn't really see through what it could have done. But if it did, wouldn't he be amazing in it?
The film does not deliver his character on any of those things. It just turns up the camp of the character,
yeah,
and the kind of
the pomp, petulance,
the petulance, and mm-hmm. It's
the more two-dimensional, less interesting facets, I think.
Okay, I've got to shut down the Joaquin Phoenix chat because it'll make sense for the end of the show. I think, you know, I've got a little thing up my sleeve for our little Movies you forgot game. And
is it a tiny little ball bag?
Well, let's find out. So that's Phoenix.
Okay. Yeah.
It's been a dusty long road. I really need to fully unleash on the movie, right?
I guess so. I mean, now I feel as though it's not going to be my Hollywood, you know, fairy tale ending, but go on.
I rewatched Gladiator with such an open heart.
Uh-huh.
And I just found it so boring and so just sort of dead to me. And I think it's because I don't like Romans. And, like, you know, there's this big joke, there's this big modern thing, like, where men have this, like, what's your Roman Empire thing? Uh-huh. It's like a whole meme. Like,
when was the last time you thought about the Roman Empire is the meme?
Right. And I have no idea. I don't get it. I don't get what that means and what it's supposed to mean to me.
You say, like, we'll block party around during the Roman Empire. No. Well, then I've never thought about it ever.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So my hackles already rise at the very notion of the Roman Empire.
Sure.
So, you know, I tried so hard and...
You came so far, but in the end, it didn't even matter, did it?
It didn't even matter. And I kept trying to think about nice things I could say.
I think you did a pretty good job of that. To be honest, now I'm hearing this, I'm glad I'm hearing it now rather than at the beginning of the episode. It would have taken the wind out of my sails a little bit. Because I love this film, and I know that, you know, there will be many listeners that will like it or have a soft spot for it as well. So I commend you on looking for some good things about it. I think it was a good structure to tell us later on that you were bored by it, and keep that to yourself for a good hour there. So good job, well done.
You know, I don't want to be a nitpicker.
Sure.
I don't want to be a naysayer.
No.
There was a reason why I don't think I'd ever wanted to rewatch this film.
Uh-huh.
And then I rewatched it, and then I found out. And then I just was watching it with this real deep melancholy, because I just thought, I just kept seeing me just like stamping all over your heart and like smushing you like a big bully.
Yeah.
And it made me feel really sad.
Right. It's funny because it makes me feel sad also that you didn't feel anything when you were watching it. Not that you should. I mean, other films make you feel things. I'm happy about that. This film genuinely makes me weep. It does. Every time I watch it, there are moments where I cannot contain my tears during this film. For whatever reason, and perhaps it's because of what I'm personally bringing to it, it just gets me going, man. Like, not only does it get me going, it unhooks me, it unzips me, yeah? I spool out like a waterfall. And that's one of the reasons I love watching it, because it's just, it never fails to do that. Even when I think, oh, it's not going to get me this time, certain things will happen and then I'll go, you know, it's wonderful. But I feel sorry for you that you didn't get that. I want you to have that too. And I don't even have a kid. So like, I'm imagining that my kid's dead. You've got kids. You know, I would have thought it would be easier for you to put yourself in Rusty Crowe's shoes.
That's the thing, as soon as my kids are dead, I'm just like driving off a cliff. It's like not even...
Right.
I wouldn't...
He didn't have a car. There were no cars around.
Okay, fine. I'm on a horse and I'm riding off a cliff.
Did you like the two horses detail? Did you like that?
What two horses detail?
In a shit film, Russell Crowe rushes home to try and save his family with one horse, right? In a good film, Russell Crowe rushes home to save his family with two horses, and then halfway through, there's suddenly just one horse. It's a lovely little detail. It was unnecessary, right? But somebody took the time to think, hang on, mate, he's going from Germany to Spain. There's no way one horse is making it the whole way if he's really in a rush. So he has to pull one behind him. And then when that other one's dead, he gets on the one he was pulling behind him. It's just a lovely little detail that a shit film doesn't have.
It's a lovely detail, right, that I didn't see, but a better film, you see the time he goes. It's this long story it's told at such a fucking lick, which is what my beef about, oh, he's not a gladiator and then he's suddenly a gladiator. He's got two horses and he's got one horse. That is in such a blink of an eye. You've spotted that. Fair play. I like the detail, but you've spotted that because you've seen it a million fucking times. I want to see that horse die. Why is this film so long and that we don't have that detail to see the horse die? That's just for like little gladiator fanboys.
What about the music? Come on, the music's lovely in this film.
This brings me to Hans Zimmer.
Uh-huh. All roads lead to Hans.
Now, I would say the music is not by Hans Zimmer, but by Trite Zimmer.
Oh,
this is
no.
this music is hack Zimmer. and the only reason, and this made this, and I'm not going to back this up. I'm going to say Hans Zimmer's Nolan soundtracks elevated Zimmer to a whole other plane. Okay? Like, Gladiator soundtrack, you could place that on Pirates of the Caribbean and it would sound exactly, it would be like, oh yeah, I'm watching the same film. You could place it on The Rock.
No.
Yes,
no,
you could.
No.
Listen.
You can't.
This is me.
I hope it is, because the Nolan fanboys. I really love the Hans Zimmer Nolan soundtracks, right? But they are absolutely not a fucking jot on what that man did for The Lion King, right? And they're no better than what he did for Gladiator or what he did for Pirates of the Caribbean. They really aren't. They might be to your taste, but like what he did for the, I listened to King of Pride Rock this morning. Okay, that shit makes me cry, man. Like, that is unbelievable music.
I'm gonna pull it back. I thought it was a funny thing.
You best pull it back, man.
Someone had the temerity to call Nolan my guy, because for some reason it was over WhatsApp, and I really bristled at that. And he's like, sure, he's not my guy, all right?
Well, you talk like he is. I mean, only someone who for whom Nolan was their guy would say the kind of things that you've just said. But, you know, let's leave that there. That's just a... I'll just leave that hanging there. There's no need to respond to that.
Bonjour. Nice sweater.
Shall we play the box office game?
I'd absolutely bloody love to play the box office game. And the box office game today is for the film Gladiator, just to remind you. Now, Adam, what I'll be asking for here is a brackets estimated budget, the budget that's included on the IMDb page for Gladiator. That's where we'll be starting. So what do you think for Gladiator?
It's 2000.
It's 24 years ago, man.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
It's still a spectacle. It's a big film.
Is there a longer gap between an original film and a sequel that follows on from that story than 24 years? I'm sure there is, but
great,
like,
question. Who knows?
Who knows? Not you.
There's a decent gap between Godfather 2 and Godfather Part 3, but not 25 years.
Don't think so, yeah. I'm going to go through the list for you very quickly, okay? Yeah? The first one, right, is Finding Nemo and Finding Dory. There was 13 years between those films.
Tell me the gap and then give me the genre and then I might land one.
Oh, yeah, you might. Okay, this is great. The gap is 14 years and it's Pixar films, from something to something two.
Oh, so it's Toy Story 3, Toy Story 4?
It is not.
Is it... what other did they sequelize? Oh, we're only going from 1 to 2, right?
The first one came out in 2004.
Sequelized. Oh, mate, no, forget it. I've come blanking.
It was The Incredibles.
Oh, yes, that was a long gap.
Yeah, big old long gap.
And second, I did not care for at all.
This one doesn't count, right? So this is where Collider.com has got this all wrong, because next it says the gap of 14 years between Jurassic Park and Jurassic World. Guess what? Wrong, mate. That's wrong. The gap was 4 years between Jurassic Park and The Lost World Jurassic Park. How dare you? Fuck's sake. They've missed out Jurassic Park 3 as well. They're saying that first three, and then the gap between that first three and the next three. It's the Star Wars thing all over again. We're not interested in that.
No, that doesn't count. That's absolutely not even connected.
Here's a really fun one. The gap is 17 years, and it's actually between films 2 and 3, not 1 and 2. But I'm going to tell you that film number 1 came out in 1995.
But the long gap is between 2 and 3.
Yeah. Then number 2 came out in 2003. When crucial evidence vanished from police custody, two detectives were hot on the trail to recover the evidence and catch the suspects. That's a synopsis for the first film. In the second film, they were promoted to Miami Police Department Tactical Narcotics Team.
Oh, it's Bad Boys.
It's Bad Boys 2 and Bad Boys 3, a gap of 17
That's
years.
That's a good one. I mean, the film's not, but there we go. That's what you're talking about.
Now, here's an interesting one. We're still shorter than Gladiator at this time, bear in mind, okay? But this is a good fun one. The gap here is 19 years, and it's actually between film 3 and film 4. And let me tell you,
film
3 came out in 1989.
It's Indiana Jones. It's Indiana Jones Crystal Skull
Crusade.
It's Crusade.
It's Last Crusade to Crystal Skull.
Crusade to Crystal Skull. Yeah. Fat time.
Very nice. And 19 years that you nailed right there. How about this one? 20 years, still sub-Gladiator. And it's between number 3 and then what would be called number 4, but actually they did that thing where they just did it again and it didn't have a number. Do you know what I mean? Where they do that sometimes?
Yeah, I think I know what you mean.
Yeah, you know what I'm saying. The original film came out in 1982. Then there was a second in 85. Then there was a third in 88. And then it was 20 years before the fourth film.
Hellraiser.
It wasn't Hellraiser, but I tell you what, the main character did a lot of hellraising in this one, because the joke is often that he just keeps killing more and more people exponentially as the films go on.
And like Freddy Krueger?
In film number 1, I think he kills one person. In film number 4, he mows down hundreds.
Oh, Terminator?
John, who's a Vietnam veteran.
Oh, Rambo.
Traveled to Washington looking for his friend. It is Rambo. There you go, Rambo. Okay, we're entering now. We've got three films that are above Gladiator level. So Gladiator's going to enter this world at number 4. Very interesting. Very interesting. Okay.
Very interesting.
And two of these came out pretty recently. Going to start with the first of them. There is a 33-year gap between these two films. The first one of which came out in 1988. And it's a comedy movie.
Ghostbusters 2 and then the Ghostbusters Afterlife?
It's a good guess, that. But it is between a 1 and 2.
A Ghostbusters comedy movie.
How about this? The character had everything at his fingertips. He was set to marry a woman before he abdicated the throne. He wanted to take matters into his own hands and decided that he'd find a wife and love regardless of his economic status. He ventured to New York and disguised himself as a typical New Yorker.
Coming to America. I used to love that. Me and my brother, we watched that film. And my sister, she watched it too. The royal penis is clean. What a fucking line, man. What a fucking line.
Okay, just two more now. This is again between number 1 and number 2, although they're not called 1 and 2. There's a kind of... The first one is just It, and then the second one is It, colon, something. The gap is 36 years, and the first one came out in 1986. And I tell you what, I haven't seen the second one, but everyone says it was terrific.
Christ, what?
36 years would mean that the second movie came out in 2022, by the way. And it was 100% a big film.
Oh, Top Gun Maverick.
Yeah, there you go. It's the original film,
Kaboom,
colon, original
character mate. Name.
Kaboom.
Kaboom.
Now, the final one you'll never get, but I'll test you anyway. The gap was 64 years, okay? And it was between film number one and film number two, setting a world record for the longest gap between sequels. A total of 64 years was these two films. In the first film, it's really impossible for me to tell you this without telling you exactly what the film was, but I'll skip that first line. Curious about the world around him, he examined the surrounding forest. He befriended a shy skunk and a grey rabbit.
I mean, is it animated?
Yeah, and he slipped down a little slippery icy hill after his mother was shot.
Oh, Bambi?
It's Bambi. Yeah, Bambi 1 and Bambi 2, 64 years apart.
Really?
There
that
you
Bambi
go.
2 wasn't a cinematic release, though, so I think that's discounted.
Oh, that is dishonest. Bambi 2 was not considered a separate movie. It blended events from the 1942 movie, but expanded more on Bambi's journey as a young fawn. Oh, fine. Okay, so it's not even a separate film.
Yes.
So that's Tom Cruise, then. Tom Cruise does it again, Adam. He does it again.
Your favourite, Timothy Cruise.
Well, speaking of money, how much money do you think it costs to make the film... that's a weird tangent. I don't know what that meant. make the film the budget for the film Gladiator. Remember we were talking about the film Gladiator with Rusty Rockets? No, with Rusty Cruise.
Rusty Cruise. Yeah, no, I can... In the mists of time, I think I can remember us chatting about this. How much did it cost? It cost much. Let's say it cost $100 million.
Oh, ba 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 Pretty easy guess, I would say, because when you don't know and it's a big movie, you can just say $100 million. And these people do seem to spend pretty scarily close to $100 million fairly regularly. But we're going to move into the difficult territory now, okay? And I'll tell you what, you'll be much luckier if you get the Scatman revisiting you here. But opening weekend, US and Canada, May the 7th, 2000. How much money do you think it took? Just 3 days.
I'm going to go high. I'm going to say 80 million.
Oh, the Scatman is sad to inform you that he can't make your tea party because it didn't do that well. It did well, but not that well. It did $35 million on its opening weekend. So just under half your guess.
That's rubbish. That's a rubbish opening weekend. That's close to Jumper territory.
Sure. But does it claw back the babes in gross worldwide? Please guess for me how much money it made.
Yeah, it keeps going. This is the little engine that could, the big engine that could.
Yeah.
And it...
The train grows as it moves.
It made, let's try for $490 million.
Oh!
You're joking.
Isn't the scat, man? $465 million this film took. So you're well within the 10% allotment there, and that's why the scat man paid you a visit.
I'm sorry I said it was boring.
No, don't worry. I wasn't expecting you to enjoy it, but I'm glad we got to watch it and talk about it. And you know what? It hasn't done, you saying it was boring. It hasn't changed how I feel about it at all. I love that film. I'm scared of Gladiator 2, though.
Just don't go and see it.
I think I might not.
Should we play the movies you forgot game?
I'd love to. What's that, Adam?
Well, this is the part of the show where one of us reads out a list of movies they think the other one has forgot they even saw in the first place. And we've rejigged the rules where we just read out a list of five.
Mm-hmm.
And if we don't get a happy resolution, we have a kind of a reserve list of which our wonderful listeners can chip into, and we will add if we consider them worthy.
Yeah.
So do email us the movies you forgot at moviesyouforgot@gmail.com.
Yeah.
Or, you know, and also follow me at
It's good that you made a username that you can't say aloud.
At Error of Ways on Letterboxd.
Yeah.
I will follow you back. I know it's back in the mists of time in this episode, but remember when we were talking about Joaquin Phoenix and I popped a little pin in it?
Yes, I remember.
It was for this part of the show. For my upcoming list.
Do tell.
Well, can you guess what's going to happen?
I'm just reaching in the dark here, yeah? Stop me if I get too radical. But are you going to theme this around Joaquin Phoenix? Am I picking up what you've put down?
Bingo, bango, bongo.
Oh.
These will all be very much themed around Joaquin Phoenix. I'm going to get you on one. I'm going to plumb you. And
the whack theme.
The whack theme. And as a result, it means we're going to talk about the whack theme.
Yeah.
On that
big time, big time. Oh man, I'd love to do that. Okay, cool. Hit me.
So here we go. Here's the list of five. There's only five.
Yeah.
Signs.
No, I remember that. I remembered that he was in Signs. And let me just say also, you told me earlier not to reappraise myself of his filmography, so I didn't. But that did mean that I've been thinking throughout the day. What was he in?
Okay.
And I remember. I think I'm going to preempt another film that's on your list.
Let me say the list.
Okay,
and then
fine.
You can veto any of them.
All I'll say is I suddenly remembered one film that he was in before Gladiator, and I think it's the only one that I know. But go on, carry on.
Then I'm not listing any of those.
Okay.
Walk the Line.
I will never forget that film. Simply because I loved it so much as a teenager when it came out. I'm a huge Johnny Cash fan. And I think he's terrific in that film. I also think Reese Witherspoon is great in that film. I think it's one of the really good music biopics. I don't think there are that many of them.
The next three, we will end up doing all of these next three films I'm going to list.
Okay.
So the question is now, which one do I say first?
Okay.
And also, which one you veto?
Yeah.
Joker.
Oh,
if you don't want to do it yet,
can I just hear the other two? Can I hear the other two first?
Okay, Her.
Her. Like I would love to do, but I really like that film. I've watched it, I would say, five times maybe, and every time I just like it even more. So if you think that's a film that you've forgotten, I'd love to add that to my list at some point. But I could never knowingly agree to that on my terms.
Okay, add it to your list for me.
I will.
Okay, last one. I know this is the one.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
Okay, I'm going to say it. You Were Never Really Here.
You will never get me on that. And actually, you tried to get me on that before, and we did a whole joke about what that episode would be like. And it was me saying, we'll talk about Joaquin and stuff and the pedo thing, and then we'll spend 20 minutes on how Johnny Greenwood just makes music by hitting every item in his kitchen, you know? I like that film. I am surprised that it's made this list again. But there you go.
Okay, so we're going to do Joker.
Oh, God.
All right, so that was the Gladiator episode.
Yay.
I'm sorry if Joe sounds so deflated. It's because I said his favourite film was a little bit shit and he's a bit sad about that.
It's actually because I have to watch Joker before next week.
Oh, listen, we all have to watch Joker before next week. Not just you.
Oh, God.
Yeah. I don't want to do that either.
No. Are you going to watch Joker too?
Yeah, because we both have to, because it's next week's
episode.
That's
very funny. That's very funny. I knew you were going to do that. I knew it.
I love that joke, and I'll never not make it. Do you know what? I don't know if I'm going to watch Joker 2 or not. I feel like I might. Well, get suckered into it depending on what people I know say about it. Not reviews,
right. You
know, the man on the street,
yeah.
My pals. But I'll pick up on the Letterboxd vibes. Although most people on Letterboxd seem to really like the first one, and I didn't.
No, nor did I. I'd be happy for us to shit on that.
Well, we got to be careful. I feel like it's if you just shit on a film for an hour. Is that fun?
Yeah.
Hey,
If no, it's not. But I'm going to be looser than normal next week, so you're going to have to continue the trend that you've started this week.
Yeah, I'll be kind. I think it works. When you shit on something, it's actually quite fun, whereas when I do it, it just feels...
Sounds vicious.
Oh, I'm bloody...